This is Kelly Goff of The Daily Beast, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It's the last week of February, and this week, the Trump administration readies for battle in the war against coronavirus. After a tough impeachment fight, could this actually become the biggest crisis of his presidency? And during a chaotic debate, the remaining Democratic candidates made their case in South Carolina. Will the first Southern primary be the last stand for some presidential hopefuls? After South Carolina, it's on to Super Tuesday. We'll look ahead at which issues are likely to decide contest in 14 states and America's Samoa, and which candidates are likely to emerge with fresh momentum versus which candidates are likely to face a final reckoning. And speaking of reckoning, author Linda Hirschman will join us to discuss the recent conviction of Harvey Weinstein and her book, Reckoning, The Epic Battle Against Sexual Abuse and Harassment. Now let's bring in our left, right, and center panel. Today, I'm your center, filling in for Josh Barrow, and I'm joined by Henry Olson, senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center and columnist at the Washington Post on the right. And on the left, Elizabeth Brunig of the New York Times. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
This week, coronavirus transitioned from an international crisis to America's most pressing health emergency. It was just announced that the first case of coronavirus of unknown origin has been diagnosed in America, specifically in Northern California. This means that an American resident with no immediately identifiable trail of contagion has contracted the illness. Meanwhile, White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney asserted the press is overhyping the virus to try to hurt President Trump politically. President Trump spoke to the press to give his thoughts on the coronavirus threat.
There's no reason to be panicked about. But when I mentioned the flu, I said, actually, I asked the various doctors, I said, is this just like flu? Because people die from the flu. And this is very unusual. And it is a little bit different, but in some ways it's easier and in some ways it's a little bit tougher. But we have it so well under control. I mean, we really have done a very good job. Go ahead.
I will say that I'm no doctor, but medical experts seem to agree that the virus is not actually easier than the flu. But as a testament to just how seriously President Trump is taking the COVID-19 threat, he appointed Vice President Mike Pence head of the new coronavirus task force. Henry, I want to start with you. There was some immediate blowback to the fact that Mike Pence is head of the coronavirus task force because as governor of Indiana, he presided over the state's worst HIV outbreak. And I thought that was a bit of a stretch to kind of compare being governor of a state that's dealing with an HIV outbreak to being appointed head of a task force with a very different kind of health concern. But specifically what people were pointing out is that part of why the HIV outbreak reached to new heights while he was governor was because of his opposition to needle exchange programs. And so basically the criticism I've been hearing is that it's kind of indicative of an overall rejection of scientific basis for policy that the Trump administration, the president himself, and the vice president hold. And there's a concern that that is part of what slowed a more aggressive response to coronavirus, and that appointing the vice president head of this task force is actually not proof that the administration is moving in the right direction. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that's just another example of Trump derangement syndrome, you know, version 3563. There's just nothing this president can do that can possibly be applauded as something that's good for the country. I think putting the vice president in charge shows that he's taking it seriously. He's putting somebody who's directly responsible to him and elected by the people. So there's political accountability, unlike when President Obama put Ron Klain in charge of the Ebola outbreak in 2014, you know, an appointed staffer responsible to the vice president. No one thinks that Mike Pence is going to be sitting here making, or no rational person thinks that Mike Pence is going to be sitting here making decisions about the details of the response. What he's doing is convening the experts who are going to be making those decisions and providing political accountability. I think that's a right decision to make, and I think people who are trying to do otherwise are people who are putting politics above the public good.
Well, one of the things, though, I read is that the concern that the fact that this administration has been slow to fill a lot of positions. So, for instance, there are nearly 700 vacant positions at the CDC, that crises like these are the moments where that comes back to haunt a president. Is that true, or what are your thoughts, having covered a number of administrations?
Yeah, well, you know, I I have not, the CDC hiring practices is not my usual beat at the Washington Post, so I can't say that this is above or behind what other administrations have done. You know, I think what we can take solace in is exactly one of the things that many people don't like about the president, which is America first. You know, that this is a person who is going to, as he said in his press conference, put the safety of Americans first, all other considerations going second. And that means, I think, that if he needs to make the politically charged decisions to reduce imports or travel to economically significant countries, he's going to do it. And he's not going to bat an eyelash about it. And he's going to move on with that. And then I think he's likelier to take, at this point, quick decisions that could be criticized for being overreactions rather than the contrary. I think that the president has behaved perfectly well in this case, and I think we might actually see this as being one of his finer hours, much to the surprise of his legion of detractors.
One of the realities we're now facing is that the virus is not just having dire medical implications, it is having a devastating impact on the global economy. It actually just marked the worst week for the stock market since the 2008 economic crash. So, Liz, I guess my first question to you is the fact that Mike Pence has essentially been deputized by the president to lead the response to this virus really a reaction to trying to solve the medical crisis we're facing, or is it, as some people posit, the president's efforts to stop the crisis from tanking the economy, which frankly has been the issue that is making a second term for him look well within reach? Because even for people who may not love him or love his tweets, the economy has been doing fairly well for a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure it's a little bit of both, right? Anytime anyone is appointed to a very public position aimed at sort of steadying the ship in circumstances like these, I think Ron Klain was the Ebola czar and was much ballyhooed for similar reasons. The idea is to control the incident, to try to limit infections and to direct a public health response, but also and not ridiculously, right? This is a very, very important role to try to manage the public response. So in these public health crises, the way that the public responds is extremely important in terms of determining health outcomes. And it's also just important in terms of people's quality of life. If there is a huge economic impact, that hurts people. And it doesn't hurt people in the same way, and perhaps not as dramatically, as getting sick or losing someone to an illness. But it does hurt people. And so I don't think it's ridiculous for a president in Trump's position to be, you know, thinking of ways to manage sort of public sentiment. I'm not sure that appointing Mike Pence the COVID-19 czar has actually made anyone feel much better about it. But I do think that is, you know, part of Trump's effort there. And it's not a ridiculous effort.
I had actually forgotten about this, but not about Hurricane Katrina, but in terms of the political fallout having some legs, meaning one of the things that I was reminded of in just reading the coverage of this virus is that the Bush administration, as we all know, was widely criticized for how it responded to Hurricane Katrina. And the GOP ended up suffering significant losses in the midterm elections afterward. Could this health crisis end up having a profound impact not only on the presidential election, but on other races throughout the country?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that, you know, if we do see widespread community transmission of COVID-19, lots of people get sick, hospitals are overwhelmed, and crucially, a lot of people will be able to move to the front of the line and others won't be able to based on their income. So I think, you know, if a circumstance like that happens and you see lots of poor people, lots of elderly people struggling to get the kind of care that well-to-do people can secure very easily, I think that will highlight critiques that folks like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren have been making of the American healthcare system, that, you know, it's a for-profit industry. It's a business, not a right. As my former colleague, Megan McArdle, once wrote, that is the reality of it in the United States. And the reality is pretty ugly and pretty easily discerned to be ugly in the event of a pandemic.
Well, that's certainly one of the defining stories of the last couple of weeks, and we're going to keep our eyes on it. What other stories are you both keeping your eyes on? Henry, I'll start with you.
The story I'm keeping an eye on that doesn't really get a lot of attention is what's been going on in Alaska over the last year. That you've got a deep red state where the governor tried to enact Republican orthodox economic policy, which is cutting government dramatically in order to right-size the budget. And he's subject to a recall. And he's been backtracking as fast as possible. And I've been writing about this. I think it's just another piece of proof that Republican economic orthodoxy of small government at all cost is dramatically unpopular in the country. And it's one that if Republicans were following more closely, you would see a lot saner economic policy coming out of Washington from the side of the elephants than you often see. So it's something that I regularly recur back to because I think it's very instructive about where the mind of the American people are, which is very different from where a lot of people on the conservative movement think it is.
So if you were a betting man and you had to gamble right now, what do you think are the odds of Governor Dunleavy of Alaska being recalled?
About 50-50. You know, is that they don't do very much polling up there, but if you take a look at how Alaskans vote, they actually would prefer somebody from the center right to the right. And what drastic budget cuts do is scare those people into saying that the thing they value more, which is public services, are at threat. You know, that he was talking about cutting the budget of the University of Alaska by 40%. Talk about a way to get moderate Republicans deciding that you're not fit for the office. And he was doing it in order to maintain, increase the annual check that each Alaskan receives from the permanent fund, which is funded by oil revenues, from $1,600 a person to $3,200 a person. If you can't get a family of four excited about getting $6,400 a year extra from the government and that they would prefer government services, that's a pretty damning indictment of the small government agenda. And I think that's why his odds are 50-50. And I think that's why this year he's fired his budget director who set him up for this mess. And he's been running away from last year's budget as fast as he can.
Liz, what stories are you keeping an eye on this week?
In a very busy and contentious Democratic primary, lots of policies have come and gone. And Bernie Sanders released one last week that didn't get much attention in light of everything else that's happening in the news, but I think would make a huge difference in people's lives. And that is a plan for universal child care. Now, Sanders' plan is pretty straightforward. In his plan, the federal government would cover all costs for child care until kiddos go to school. Elizabeth Warren also has a child care plan, and that's a little bit more complicated in structure. Under her plan, the federal government would cover 80% of the subsidies for children and families with incomes below 200% of the federal poverty line and 50% of the subsidies for children with incomes above that amount. And then state and local governments would pick up the rest. There would be possibly, under Warren's plan, about $6,000 in user fees for some users for the child care plan. And under Sanders, there would be no out-of-pocket costs for any particular user. But I think what this has breached is that for lots of Americans, for lots of people, certainly for my family, the cost of childcare nearly rival the money that one or both parents make. And they seriously call into question the wisdom for a lot of folks of continuing to work after they have kids. Now, if you are someone who's interested in a robust economy, you probably don't want all parents dropping out of the workforce, and you don't want a huge reduction in labor supply. So available child care is pretty important. And it's a matter of quality of life for families to be able to pay for child care without struggling financially in these crucial early years for childhood development. So while it's not a big thing yet, and you don't hear people talking about it as much as health care, I think we should keep our eyes on child care.
I have a question. You know, David Brooks had a really fabulous piece in The Atlantic this past week on titled The Nuclear Family Was a Mistake. The title doesn't do it justice, and I encourage everyone to read it. But I thought it was really fascinating because one of the things that it made me think about, Liz, is this whole concept of family and what the American family should look like and how it's really has evolved over centuries and is continuing to evolve. And so I'm wondering if part of why the Sanders proposal didn't get as much coverage is because this is not as much of a defining issue as perhaps people expected it would be. Because, for instance, I'm child-free by choice. I've chosen not to have kids. When I first, you know, discussed that decision, I think, you know, publicly in a piece like years ago, it was still considered kind of, you know, an oddity or interesting. And at this point, about a third of millennials, according to polls, don't want children. So I'm wondering if this really is considered is a universal issue, or is really will is perhaps more of a niche issue than you than even Sanders supporters realized.
You know, if we're going to have a huge reduction in people having children, people that is, if there are going to be a, is if there's a huge increase in people who won't have children, that's a big problem for the economy. And it's a big problem for social reproduction and a whole other host of things. So it makes the having of children all the more precious and something that governments should be interested in subsidizing even more.
Or immigration.
Right. I mean, but they also could elect not to have children. Right. So like once they get to America and become acculturated to American culture and decide that they are similar to Americans, they may take on the perspective that they, too, do not want children. So then we're back in the same place that we were. So it would seem like, you know, if we're going to be moving globally towards higher education, higher incomes, fewer children or no children, then government should be even more tilted towards subsidizing and encouraging childbearing, you know, to avoid the problems, say, Japan is having with their aging population.
We're actually out of time. I've been talking with Liz Brunig of The New York Times and Henry Olson of The Washington Post. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our left, right, and center, and we want to hear from you, too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Kelly Goff of The Daily Beast, sitting in for Josh Barrow. On the right is Henry Olson, columnist at The Washington Post. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, columnist at The New York Times. So there was just another Democratic primary debate, only this one was special because it had not one, but two billionaires in it. This debate was significant for another reason. It seemed to be universally panned. Congresswoman Debbie Dingell called it a disgrace, and it seemed that everyone from voters to media columnists all dubbed it kind of a disaster, with too much shouting and moderators that lost control. On the other hand, I know that I've spent much of this election cycle listening to people complain about how boring and useless some of the other debates were. So the first question I have, which I'll direct to Henry, is what makes a good debate? A debate that is actually useful to voters? And then could you rate the South Carolina debate beyond its entertainment value? Like, can you rate it in terms of how useful it actually was to voters?
Yeah, I think it's very difficult for a debate as large as these Democratic debates to be useful to voters, that you don't get enough back and forth or time for people to explore their differences because there's seven people on the stage, or in some cases, there were 10 people on the stage. And so the only way to break through and get the all important for campaign purposes post-debate media buzz is to have a scripted exchange or some good one-liners. And I don't think that's very useful to voters at all. I think a good debate, and what I would love to see them do more of, is things or good television experiences, or like the CNN town halls, where you have people who have time to answer questions, time to interchange ideas with people of an audience. I think that is useful to voters because you actually get to see a candidate's thoughts and some depth of thought, as opposed to the quick repartee and attempts to avoid the question the moderator asks, so you can answer, spew out the pre-canned talking points that has been focus grouped by your strategist. So on that score, I would say the debate's usefulness, if 10 is highly useful and one is not useful at all, at about a 3. You learn very little about what the candidates actually think. And the person who you did learn about, you know, Amy Klobuchar keeps seeing, I tweeted during that debate that she seemed to be getting all the policy nerd questions. Senator Klobuchar, please tell me about your rural health plan. Well, if you cared about that, you actually got to learn something about Amy Klobuchar's rural health plan. But for most people, same old, and a lot of shouting and a lot of disorder. It was more reminiscent of a WWE match than a serious political endeavor.
Well, then I'm surprised more people didn't seem to enjoy it. I actually have to say, though, to your point, I didn't know.
Oh, because they're fun personalities on WWE. I mean, everybody was the heel and nobody was the face on this one.
And no one had interesting costumes. I will say, though, I didn't actually see Senator Klobuchar's tweet. But what's funny about you saying that is that I had a conversation with a couple people who said, you know, I felt like I actually learned quite a bit about Senator Klobuchar's policy credentials and bona fides from the debate. Liz, what do you think makes a good and useful debate? And where did this one stack up as far as useful debates go in your mind?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's tough to have a good debate, right? Because there are so many people still in the field. And a lot of these debates are quote unquote debates. They don't really function to highlight ways in which the opponents differ from one another and to give them a chance to argue for their perspective. They more just give the candidates an opportunity to sort of say their piece and for voters to hear them interrogated on issues they might be avoiding on the campaign trail. So in that sense, I do think they're quite useful. This one, it was less like a WWE match and more like watching The View, right? It's just like a bunch of people sort of like cattily chattering over each other.
But Liz, who played the Meghan McCain character on stage?
Let me say, I do like The View. it's a different experience than I think most people are going for when they watch a presidential debate. So I do think this was among the worst of the presidential debate so far, you know, precisely because it was really difficult to even discern what was going on. And that is the value add of these debates, is that you can hear people. But I do think it did bring one thing home, and that's the degree to which the remaining candidates are attempting to distinguish themselves from one another down at the last moment. So as we come to these really important primaries like South Carolina, they're trying to explain to voters who they are and the ways in which they differ from one another. I think that's especially important for folks like Klobuchar, Buttigieg, who are still occupying a kind of center lane, trying to break out from that center position as the front runner.
I'm going to ask a political nerd question because I love political history, which is, well, it seems to me like when I was a kid that there were these, you know, breakout moments from debates that literally became a defining part of political lexicon and a defining part of American culture. You know, I think back to Senator Lloyd Bentsen, who's from my home state of Texas, saying to Dan Quayle, "Senator, I served with Jack Kennedy. I knew Jack Kennedy. Jack Kennedy was a friend of mine. Senator, you're no Jack Kennedy." A line that is so popular that it actually has its own Wikipedia page, I discovered. A political line that actually has its own Wikipedia page. And then, of course, there was Ronald Reagan's famous line to address concerns about his age when he said to Walter Mondale during the 1984 debate, "I want you to know that I will not make age an issue on this campaign. I am not going to exploit for political purposes my opponent's youth and inexperience." How come we don't have moments that become defining parts of our culture from modern day debates? Does anyone have theories about that, Henry?
Yeah, I think part of it is, you know, both debates that you mentioned there are one-on-ones. And it was much easier to, you know, in both cases, the ones you mentioned are a contrast. You know, I am X, you are Y. One was humorous and one was not. It's very difficult in a multi-stage debate. A lot of these debates now are being played not to lose because, you know, it's very hard to score winning line, but it's very easy to score a losing line, like the Rick Perry. And so consequently, people don't try to have that knockout line that we remember because they want to avoid the Rick Perry screw up that people remember for the wrong reasons.
I usually think debates, at least in the modern era, don't seem to have that much of a capacity to alter a race significantly. But I was surprised. Joe Biden had one of the stronger debate performances, I think, of this election cycle in South Carolina. And apparently voters agreed because he was barely leading Sanders before this debate. And after the debate, they just released a poll yesterday that shows him up by about 20 points. Frankly, the largest surprise actually to me was the fact that Tom Steyer is apparently third in South Carolina, which I didn't know that he had become such a force there. So, Liz, do you think that South Carolina will kind of cause some of the anti-Sanders voters to coalesce around Biden? Or do you anticipate that this is going to be a long slog to Super Tuesday for any of the anybody but Sanders undecided voters? I know you're very decided, but I mean, what do you think coming out of South Carolina? Will there be a sea change?
Yeah, I don't especially expect a sea change out of South Carolina, almost because I think it's been well understood for a while now that it was very likely to be a strong state for Biden, and Biden's been focusing a lot of his efforts there. So it's not going to be a big surprise. At the same time, you know, I haven't seen the bump I would have expected for Bernie coming out of Nevada yet. And so
why
that could
signal. Why do you think that is?
Well, because I think his competitors are hanging in there. And I think that at this point, a lot of the folks who are still in the race, who have received quite a bit of money, who are still successfully fundraising, have their bases pretty locked in. So I don't see quite a lot of movement between people who are, say, diehards for Biden or diehards for Warren, diehards for Buttigieg. I think those bases have sort of acquired their own personalities at this point because those candidates continue to fundraise and have said they will stay in potentially all the way to a contested convention. Yeah. So I'm not sure.
Do you see, though, like an Amy Klobuchar hanging on? How long does she hang on? I thought she had a very strong debate performance, but I'm a little baffled even that she's frankly still in the race.
I mean, I'm a little confused about that as well. I don't know what she thinks is going to happen. I know that once people have done fundraising, they feel an obligation to their donors to stick around and not give up. And they also have staffs they don't want to let go. So it can be difficult tagging out. So for Klobuchar, I mean, that is a little more puzzling to me than somebody like Biden, who's, I think, quite obviously hoping for a big comeback. And I'm not sure that we'll see her all the way to Super Tuesday. I certainly doubt that we'll see her past Super Tuesday. These debate performances might be VP auditions. So a lot of that might be going on.
I felt watching that stage, I think that Elizabeth Warren and Amy Klobuchar have actually both run fairly impressive campaigns. But I felt, particularly in the last two debates, that I was watching two different vice president auditions. I believed what Elizabeth Warren said when the private conversation about Bernie Sanders thinking a woman couldn't be elected president. But it has not come up since there was a huge backlash among his supporters for her saying so. And she has not laid a finger on him, but in every debate has, you know, practically verbally ripped Mike Bloomberg's face off, which to me indicated that she was auditioning to be a very strong, by the way, VP contender for Bernie Sanders, because being VP is 90% about being the attack dog. And if there was ever any question that Elizabeth Warren could handle that, I think she made it loud and clear that she absolutely could. On the other hand, hearing Amy Klobuchar talk so much about how she doesn't think capitalism is a bad thing, to me signaled that she's auditioning for VP for someone else, probably a billionaire on stage. So I think you're definitely in the right direction, Liz. The closing question of the debate was very interesting. They asked people to talk about their misconceptions that voters have about them and to talk about words to live by. So I figured we could do a bit of a round robin here. I'll start with you, Henry. What are misconceptions that some of your readers might have about you, and what are your words to live by?
My instinct is to mimic or agree with Amy Klobuchar's a lot of people would think that I'm boring, more boring than I am. But I think the biggest misconception that my readers have is that I'm a Trump sycophant, when in fact I criticize Trump as much as I praise Trump. But in the current climate, people seem to want you to be 100% on one team or another, and the fact that quote one of my favorite mottos, tree beard the ant from The Lord of the Rings, I'm not on anybody's side because no one is exactly on my side. That doesn't sit very well with people. But as far as my motto, aside from tree beard, mine is Miguel Cervantes, the man who fights for his ideals is alive. It's the inscription that I put inside all of my books, and it's something that I've tried to live by.
Liz, what about you? What are misconceptions that some of your listeners and readers may have about you, and what are your words to live by?
That's a really good question. I mean, I sort of don't begrudge a lot of the candidates for avoiding the question because it's hard to answer. Misconceptions people have about me. A lot of people think I'm a lot bigger than I am when they hear my voice. I'm actually not even 5 feet tall. I think that is a big misconception I get a lot, maybe a little bit on the shallower side. I think a lot of people feel like I'm a sort of traditionalist Catholic. I am not. I'm a normie Catholic. I'm just an ordinary, everyday Catholic who goes to church. I don't have any hot takes on liturgy. I'm not upset about the Pope, generally not paying that much attention to the Pope.
And words to live by.
Words to live by. You know, I think a lot about Matthew 7:12. In everything, do unto others what you would have them do unto you. For this sums up the law and the prophets.
Those are good ones. And I have to say that the misconceptions about me, I think Liz and I are two sides of the same coin, because usually when people meet me in person, they say some version of, wow, you're much taller than I thought you'd be, because I'm actually nearly 6 feet tall. So that tends to be the first reaction I get. And my words to live by come courtesy of one of my heroes, Arthur Ashe, and they are the words on the monument in his honor at the U.S. Open, which are, from what we get, we can make a living. What we give, however, makes a life. I've been talking with Liz Brunig of the New York Times and Henry Olson of the Washington Post. We'll be back with my conversation with legal scholar Linda Hirschman on what the Weinstein verdict means for the future of the Me Too movement. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts or from the KCRW app.
Welcome back to Left, Right, and Center. I'm Kelly Goff of The Daily Beast, your center, sitting in for Josh Barrow. On the right is Henry Olson, columnist at The Washington Post. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, columnist at The New York Times. It's been a little over 2 years since a blockbuster New York Times article on movie mogul Harvey Weinstein kicked off the Me Too movement. Actress Ashley Judd and others alleged incidents of harassment and assault. This week, Weinstein was found guilty of criminal sexual act in the first degree and rape in the third degree. He was acquitted of other more serious charges. Weinstein is not the only powerful man to face a reckoning for past behavior, but his fall from grace represented a major turning point in Hollywood and American society. Author and legal scholar Linda Hirschman joins me now to discuss her book, Reckoning: The Epic Battle Against Sexual Abuse and Harassment. Thanks for joining me, Linda.
Thank you for having me.
So, Linda, your book, which is fabulous, by the way, is basically a definitive history of all of the major sexual harassment and abuse cases in American history. Before we dive into your book, I just wanted to start by asking, were you surprised by the Weinstein verdict?
I was a little surprised. I was, because rape law is a ill-fitting instrument for dealing with the kinds of behavior that he engaged in. So because rape law has its origins in the idea that women were their father's and husband's property, and they had to be protected in their purity. So the idea of the kind of woman that rape law should protect is a very, very old one. And I was afraid that that idea would creep in to the trial of Harvey Weinstein and he would be acquitted.
Well, but interesting. So I want to just follow up on that then, because I do, there's something interesting to me about that case for a lot of reasons. But, you know, since you're chronicling a lot of the major cases, one of the things I couldn't help thinking about while I was reading your book, Linda, is for the civil rights movement, there are definitive moments, right, that represented turning points, and not just in the courts, Brown v. Board of Education, but also criminal cases, the Emmett Till murder, the disappearance and murder of the three civil rights workers in Mississippi, also known
Gordon
as the Mississippi.
And Schwerner and Cheney, sure.
Exactly. So I guess my question is, why is it that certain cases become the defining cases of movements and others do not? Why did the Weinstein case break the dam for behavior that a lot of people knew had been going on for a long time? Why was that the case that broke the dam?
So I think that there's an argument that the Bill Cosby conviction actually is entitled to consideration for the landmark case. So we mustn't forget the tremendous effort that the mostly black and brown complaining women made to bring Bill Cosby to justice. And that conviction came first. So I think that it's often a cluster. It's often a cluster.
Can I just stop though for really quickly? Because the first time he wasn't convicted, and Cosby actually ended up being convicted after the Weinstein story broke. And I do think there's a connection. So that's why, again, so I'm curious, what do you think it was about specifically the Weinstein case that reignited the conversation?
Again, it was two matters. It was the Gretchen Carlson's Civil Rights Act lawsuit against Roger Ailes, and the fact that Fox News conceded so quickly.
Oh, interesting.
And then it was the Weinstein case. So Carlson's suit against Roger Ailes and her outing of Roger Ailes for the abuser that he was comes a year earlier than the articles in the New York Times and the New Yorker. So Weinstein's case both makes new law, like Brown did, but it also matters because the wrongdoer was brought to criminal account. And that's the most serious, that's, you know, that's different from Brown v. Board, which was a civil case. It was a constitutional case.
Interesting. So the idea of a powerful man actually having to do time potentially behind bars as opposed to having to write a check.
And that's what everybody is saying about Weinstein. But what I want to add from the work I did on the Reckoning book is that it also represents an application of the law of rape to women who behaved like normal 20th and 21st century women. They were ambitious. They wanted to protect their careers. They were trying to make it in a very toxic work environment. They were not somebody's princess daughter locked up in a tower who was violated by, you know, a criminal stranger. This is the fact that the New York rape law was applied to protect them is a change in the law.
One of the most fascinating things to that point that I thought you made in your book, which to be quite honest, I hadn't actually thought about till I was reading your book, is this idea that part of why there is so much complexity around enforcement of sexual assault law is not just because of misogyny, but because most behaviors that are criminalized, it's clear cut that we as a society consider them morally abhorrent. Whipping a human being that you have chained up and treating as beneath you, we as a society collectively have decided is morally abhorrent. Sex, on the other hand, is something we as a society theoretically consider to be pleasurable and enjoyable, as you explain in your book, except in certain circumstances. And those circumstances have never really taken into account the needs and wants and the empowerment of women, because that was never factored into the concept of sexuality in American culture. I thought that was a really, really profound assessment. The other thing that I thought your book did so well, and I just have to issue this explanation for listeners who may not know, I am Black, you are white. And I say that only because one of the things I found fascinating and really powerful about your book is how much you made a point of repeatedly giving credit to women of color for essentially being the backbone of this movement. You cite a number of cases and situational examples in which women of color, Black women in particular, played pivotal roles in sparking social change that benefited all women on this issue. Most people know who Anita Hill is, but for our listeners who don't know, can you tell them about Michelle Vinson and her significance in the history of sexual harassment law?
So Michelle Vinson was the plaintiff in the first case of sexual harassment that went all the way to the Supreme Court of the United States. The case is called Meritor versus Vinson for her. And she was And Black women are so often the targets of this behavior because the men pick on the least powerful person in their universe. So in a racist society, Black women are already one strike down. Michelle Vinson represents this very well. She was really poor, and she lived in a very poor section of Washington. And in her neighborhood, the Little Branch Bank was like an island of order and security, and she aspired to work there. And she got a job as a teller because she knew the supervisor, who was also Black, of this local branch. And the day he hired her, he took her to dinner and said that she had to have sex with him if she wanted to keep her job. And like they say in the musical, oh God, she needed that job. And he made her life a living hell for 4 or 5 years, following her into the vault, raping her, exposing himself to her, having what would pass for consensual sex with her. It's a lot like the story that those women told in the Weinstein trial, that weird mixture of a powerful man who can control your living and you sometimes grudgingly concede that you all have sex with him, and sometimes it's actually rape. This is just like Meritor versus Vinson. And finally, she couldn't stand it anymore, and she quit, and he fired, and she took sick leave, and he fired her, and she sued him. And that case went all the way to the Supreme Court of the United States. And the court ruled unanimously that the creation of a hostile work environment like the supervisor did to Michelle Vinson was a violation of Title VII, the Equal Employment Laws. And Michelle Vinson was the third in a line of Black women plaintiffs who made the early days of sexual harassment law.
I do have to, though, talk about the other side of the aftermath, which is there have been a number of studies published in the last year on the effects of the Me Too movement. And I think the positive effects are obvious, right, which is perpetrators finally being held accountable and some survivors getting long overdue justice. But the news isn't all good. The Journal of Organizational Dynamics found that in the wake of Me Too, 27% of men admitted to now avoiding one-on-one meetings with female coworkers. 21% of men said they would be reluctant to hire a woman for a job that involved business travel. And 19% of men would be reluctant to hire an attractive woman. And that actually, those actually weren't the most disturbing numbers. What was really troubling is that 10% of women in hiring positions said they also would be wary of hiring an attractive woman now. So it's not just men. So Linda, how do you fix the backlash? Is it training? Is it getting more women executives? What is the answer?
If, in fact, those people did what they said they did, they are confessing to violating the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and 1972 in print, okay? There's a reason why those people tell interviewers that that's what they're doing, but they will not give their names. It's illegal. What they are doing is illegal.
But I'm asking policy-wise how. I guess the analogy I would draw is Brown v. Board of Education made it illegal for me to receive a separate unequal education. It could not force white people to go to dinner with me. And if I can't go to dinner with you, that makes it hard for me to get a promotion at your company because you don't know me socially. So there's the morally and legally right argument, but then there's the actual day-to-day execution of how you change hearts and minds. And I believe it's absolutely possible that there were people who were absolute racist. The law came down. They had never interacted with many Black people. They started to interact with them, and either their positions evolved or they accepted that society was evolving. But a lot of that had to do with actual policy change, and also it had to do with soft change, right? The changing of culture, the seeing, you know, Black families on television, meeting Black people in social settings that didn't scare them, to be quite blunt, right? So I guess I'm asking you, what is the version of that, of how you evolve men who may be misogynist, or, you know, men, I hear this, Linda, quite honestly, men who are college students whose parents are making them wary of potential false rape allegations. That's how these men are going out into the world. So I'm asking from a policy and an actual tangible standpoint, what is the response to help to try to quell the backlash?
So the aftermath of Brown v. Board is a very harsh example because they didn't even offer you the equal education that you were entitled to by constitutional law, right? Took a generation or two generations for that to even begin to be possible. So it's social change is very slow. Mm-hmm. I think that the next generation that will be raised in the aftermath of Me Too will be better. I'm hopeful about the next generation. I'm hopeful about the urbanization and America coming together in cosmopolitan cities. So I think that women are also, and again led by Black women like Ava DuVernay, right, are moving into positions of power in the content business. So the more women that there are in writers' rooms and in directors' chairs and making movies like Little Women, which did so well, the more that that will evolve in the natural way that you're describing. Mm.
I have one last question, because I will certainly get it on social media if I don't ask. I know a lot of the backlash fears are, to your point, you know, overblown, right? Because you have a lot of powerful men, so they have power. So they should have less to be concerned about than those of us who do not. But the irony, of course, of me being a Black woman is that not only have we historically been on the receiving end of more harassment and abuse, but historically the men in our families have been more likely to be falsely accused of sex crimes and to face dire consequences. And I'm not just talking a long time ago. I mean, the murder of Emmett Till was in the 50s, but you had the Central Park Five. You just referenced Ava DuVernay, who did the beautiful a series on them, the Brian Banks case, the recent Sacred Heart University case, where two football players who are African-American were falsely accused. How do we work to ensure vulnerable women feel protected, but so do vulnerable men? What is the magic answer on that?
You know, I don't know that there's a magic answer, but their interests are not so different, because when the Central Park Five were falsely accused, the real rapist went free. And in the months after they were falsely accused and before he was caught, ultimately caught, he raped many other vulnerable women. So women do not have an interest in men being wrongfully accused of rape, because that just means that the person who actually raped them goes free. What we had in Weinstein case, for instance, was not a mistaken identity like the Central Park Five. That's a very different problem. What you had was someone that you knew was doing it, and we could not get the society to call him to account.
Well, I will say, too, and in the Sacred Heart University case, in terms of showing the evolution of culture, is that Emmett Till was murdered for a false allegation. It wasn't
a
incorrect identification. Bryant Banks, the accuser, recanted. And in the Sacred Heart University case, the woman who falsely accused him is actually supposed to be serving a year in jail. So it does show that we have evolved as a culture from lynchings to where we are now. But I think the fear has not gone away, particularly for the mothers, sisters, descendants of these communities. And that's always kind of hovering over these conversations. But I do, to your point, there is a very big difference between the lack of power of the Central Park Five when they were accused and the immense power of Harvey Weinstein and how he wielded it. And I thought that your book did a really beautiful job of kind of drawing that through line in terms of an overview of American history and sex abuse cases. So I encourage everyone to read it. The book is called Reckoning: The Epic Battle Against Sexual Abuse and Harassment. Linda Hirschman, thanks for writing this book, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Liz Brunig, it's your soapbox.
Normally, I like to reserve this time for something a little bit silly or ironic. This time, I'm going to do another public health announcement. Please, please, please don't retweet, share on Facebook, pass along to friends anything you're seeing about COVID-19 that does not come from official sources like the Centers for Disease Control, the World Health Organization. Spreading panic is one of the biggest risks involved in a pandemic. It causes people to act irrationally and unpredictably, which makes it hard for public health workers to help us. Do not panic, and do not share anything that's going to induce panic. Hang in there.
Henry Olson, what's your rant?
Yeah, my rant is personal and cultural, which is I was listening to music yesterday as I was flying in here to Phoenix, and I was listening to a song from the 1960s and just thinking how beautiful the singer's voice was, how melodic the music was, and that this was the winner of the Eurovision Song Contest. And thinking, why don't we have these songs that chart nowadays? Why does everything have to be overproduced and loud and often risque? And there I'm betraying my cultural conservatism in thinking that maybe something that happened, that things that were cultural norms 50 or 60 years ago were actually good things, and maybe we should return to them.
For my rant, the words "better late than never" felt particularly apropos this week. In the final days of Black History Month, Congress voted to make lynching, historically one of the most notorious forms of terrorizing and torturing Black Americans, a federal crime. The bill was first introduced more than 100 years ago. While high-profile cases like the 1955 murder of 14-year-old Emmett Till by a group of angry white men generated headlines, most of the nearly 5,000 victims of lynching did not. The National Memorial for Peace and Justice, informally known as the National Lynching Memorial, opened in 2018. And just days ago, a monument was unveiled to posthumously honor the Groveland Four, black teenagers falsely accused of assaulting a white woman 70 years ago. One of the teenagers was murdered by a posse. Four conservative congressmen, Justin Amash, Thomas Massey, Louis Gohmert, and Ted Yoho, voted against the federal anti-lynching bill. They should be ashamed of themselves, but every single other member of Congress voted for it. In an era of hyperpartisanship where very little seems to get done, this is something all Americans can celebrate and be proud of. That's all we have time for today. Thanks to Henry Olson, Liz Brunig, and Linda Hirschman. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. And I'm Kelly Goff, filling in for Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.